It's now 7:05, so why don't we get started? We'll have a few announcements I'd like to make first. Welcome to everybody to the Dallas Philosophers Forum. Anybody has not been here before? Any visitors tonight?
Hello.
Yes. Where are you from?
Here.
Here. How did you hear about us?
Well, I attended one long time ago.
Great.
Yeah.
Good. Anybody else?
Thank you.
Yes. A visitor?
Yes.
How did you hear about us?
From my friend Ray.
Aha. Okay. Well, we know Ray. Okay. We, as you know, try to make philosophy and related subjects educational, entertaining, available. We took a poll two weeks ago, to see what kind of subjects you would like to hear for the coming session. And we tried out having this meeting start at 7 o'clock this past 6 months, and found that might be a hardship for people traffic-wise getting here so early and trying to scarf down their food before starting at 7. So we're going to go back to our old meeting time of starting at 7:30, starting in the winter. That ought to make it easier for the speaker. The poor speaker almost took 2 hours to get here today. Please pay the treasurer. Hold up. This is our ad lib treasurer, I guess. He's taking my place. Rob is our president for the lecture tonight, $5. And if you want to pay in advance for the next 10 lectures, it's $35, so you save $15. I'd like to, let's see. I'm gonna first, our next talk is January the 14th. David Prusner is going to speak on what is justice. He's a lawyer. And don't forget to pay your food bill before you leave. And also, the tip is included in your bill, so don't add that on. I'm going to say a few words, and I'm going to turn it over to Ken Souter to say a few words about our philosophy fund. Okay, Ken?
Okay. If you don't know, the Philosopher's Forum has been around for about 30 years, and we're a nonprofit. And we've been operating for 30 years, so obviously we've figured out a way to keep on going. And financially, we depend on the money you pay our treasurer, and we basically break even. I mean, some weeks we're a little behind, some weeks we're a little ahead, but it generally comes out even. But we've been contemplating a few things, and from time to time we'll do things like have a summer debate, and or maybe offer a scholarship to some students and stuff like that. We haven't been really consistent about that. But we don't have, those things cost money to put on and do things, and we have to make special arrangements to make those things happen. So our request to you is if you believe in what the Dallas Philosophers Forum does, and you'd like to maybe see a few more things or support some of those efforts, we just ask you to donate. I mean, don't feel like you have to. If you philosophically think that a nonprofit should just barely survive, then don't feel like you have to give. But we'll keep on going. But if you believe in what we're doing and you'd like to maybe see some special events or scholarships or maybe help students with gas money or something like that, contemplate doing that. And if you decide to do that, cash or checks to like whoever the treasurer is tonight's Rob. We don't have an official address. I think we do somewhere, but you won't find it on the website. And you can always send an email, and we'll respond to that within a few weeks, probably.
We're going to provide a receipt too.
Was that?
Receipt.
Yeah, and we can give you a receipt. So we just ask you to contemplate that. If you feel like giving, do it. You know, if you don't, you don't have to. But just think about it, okay?
The most important thing about that is it is tax deductible as a contribution to an educational organization. And we will use it for good purposes, not just to feed ourselves. We buy audiovisual equipment, and we offer scholarships to graduate students, philosophy students sometimes, and put on a summer program that sometimes we have to pay the participants. Anyway, so we appreciate anything that you can do for us. I'd like to introduce our speaker tonight, Dr. Kenneth Williford. He was born in Fort Worth, one of our Texas own, did his undergraduate work at UT Arlington, where he majored in philosophy, did his PhD work at the University of Iowa, and then returned to good old Texas. He is professor and chair of the Department of Philosophy at UT Arlington since 2009. He works mostly in the philosophy of mind and phenomenology and the history of modern philosophy. He's published several articles and co-edited the book, Self-Representational Approaches to Consciousness. So join me in welcoming Professor Ken Williford, who will speak on Do You Have a Self? And Does It Matter?
Is this thing working?
You're on now.
Hello. Thank you very much. And thank you for inviting me and having me again. This is my second time to speak to the Dallas Philosophers Forum, so I guess the first time was okay. Try to continue. I'll try not to mess it up this time. And thanks for coming out on this cold and somewhat item, right. So I've changed my title a little bit. Self, no self, so what? Here's the outline. So first I'll talk about the common sense conception of the self, although we'll find that it's really not that commonsensical in many ways. Arguments for and against the existence of such a self. And then, if we have time, implications for ethics, if supposing there is no such self. We may not have time to do that, but we'll try. We can always talk about that stuff in the question-answer period. Common sense self. So, if you ask yourself, what is yourself, you might think some things like, well, it's the owner of experiences. The one who's having these experiences. And by extension, the owner of things, like that's my computer, or it's the owner of actions, your actions versus someone else, and the owner of various kinds of statuses, moral status, legal status, so on. You might also think, and if it's sort of traditional in some ways to think so, that this, you need the self to unify your experiences. So you have multiple experiences, but they're all yours. So the self is a thing that makes grounds or makes sense of the fact that they're all yours. And this can be thought of either synchronically, like at one time you're having multiple experiences, seeing something, smelling something, hearing something, all at once, and over time. You might also think the self is a subject of experiences, the one to whom they are present, and so on. Current experiences, remembered ones, and unfortunately forgotten ones. Well, most of them are forgotten. It's also a common idea that it's the point of view. It's the seat of subjectivity, the point of view on the world. he used a couple of different terms. Center of narrative gravity that comes from Dennett, and autobiographical self that comes from DiMaggio. And the idea here is, when we tell our story, where we're from, where we were born, what we're into, and so on, we always do it in reference to a self. We kind of construct this picture of a self that has a certain narrative structure, and we traffic in these things. Just go on to some online dating sites, for example. Here's my narrative. True or false? Seat of personal identity. So when we look at a picture from when we were little kids, we say, that's me. Look at me now, right? That's me then. It seems like we're saying the very person there in that picture is the same one who's here now. And that what grounds this identity over time is this thing, the self. Sometimes people think of it as the seat of personality, like somehow the source of your personality, your tendencies, your traits, character traits, so on. And then, of course, the notion of agency, sort of the self as that from which decisions issue. Or as one famous person put it, I'm the decider, right? Got your little decider.
Ken.
Yes.
Oh. Can't do it.
There's more than one Ken.
No, we're stuck with that thing the way it is.
And relatedly, the seat of moral responsibility. That's, you know, where the buck stops. And finally, thinking of it in terms of epistemology, the seat of self-knowledge. And sometimes people think they have a kind of knowledge that they just, you just can't share with anybody else. So my teenage daughter often tells me, you're not me, you wouldn't understand. And I ask her, you know, can you put it into some kind of words that may, can you communicate it somehow? No, you'd have to be me. It's kind of an exaggerated type of epistemic claim about the self. So we can see in that some rough, somewhat crisscrossing divisions. Moral and socio-political aspects, by extension. Ownership, agency, responsibility, moral status. That which has rights. That which can merit things. And the object of praise and blame. Psychological aspects, or aspects related to issues in the philosophy of mind, like synchronic and diachronic unity of experience, notion of a point of view, subject, subject of memory and personality, and epistemological aspects. It's the idea of privileged access. You have access to your own mental states. Nobody else has direct access to them. Incorrigibility, that was the idea that, is the idea that you are the final arbiter of what your mental states are. You know what they are, and you can say what they are, and nobody can really, like, undermine your claim, in most cases, anyway. It can't be corrected. And this is, of course, something that people often make use of, and that make people suspicious of each other. Are you lying to me about that? Are you really sick, or are you just not want to go to school today? Yes, I feel bad. I can't really get in there and see if you're lying or not. Classically, like in Descartes, the thought was that your own self-knowledge is infallible. And more recently, we have the idea of immunity to error through misidentification. I might be able to, I might be mistaken about, you know, whose scarf that is, but I can't be mistaken about whose pain is happening right now. Can't say, oh, there's a pain in the room, and I'm not sure that it's mine. If it's mine, I don't know it. Then there are metaphysical aspects. Unification, what does that even amount to? Unifying experiences into making it into one common sort of space of experience. Individuation, what is it that makes you this individual and not another? Endurance through time. This idea that the self is this identical thing that endures over time. maintains its identity through change of properties, change of inessential properties, or accidental properties. And then if we think of it in terms of agency and so on, there's the idea of agent causation, that the decider makes decisions and then executes and decides to, you know, issue a command and do it, just cause it to happen. And that's often connected with the notion of libertarian free will. There's some completely free thing that just makes these decisions. These are somewhat optional aspects of the concept of self, but they're common enough that I thought I should mention, say a little bit about them. But I want to boil the discussion down, though, to some of the metaphysical aspects. The notion of unification, the notion of the self as an individuator, and as a something that maintains its identity through change. These are arguably the fundamental notions about a self. If there's no enduring self that serves as basis for the unity of experience and the ownership of actions, then the moral, psychological, and epistemological roles this entity is supposed to play will have to be reconceived or perhaps regarded as illusions. So let's first look at the lines of reasoning that lead people to think that there is such a self. We'll look at a few. The unity argument, the memory argument, we'll look at those as if they're basically one argument. The ownership argument, we won't look at the semantic argument, just in the interest of time. The individuation argument, and the phenomenological argument. So let's take unity and memory. So the idea here is there must be some common seat for all the different experiences you have, both at a time and over time. The same person, we want to say, sees, hears, and feels things all at the same time. And this is not merely like a bundling or co-occurrence. It's not just that there's a pain over there, and there's a taste of tea over here, and it's happening at the same time. It's more than just co-occurrence. For them to be taking place in the same mind, they have to belong to that mind, have to be unified in that mind, not just co-occurrence. And over time, the same person has different experiences, evidently. In memory, whether short-term or long-term, you know that the very one doing the memory, remembering, is the very one who had the experiences remembered. So you remember what you did this morning or what you did 10 years ago. The thought is that in remembering that, you recognize that it's you. You are the very one who had that experience. The very one who's doing the remembering right now. Then the claim is, this same person that we're referring to is the self, so there is a self. Ownership argument. Suppose that we have a group of people in a room, so like now, and suppose the following existential generalization is true, following claim is true. There is a pain in the room. No serious question can arise as to whose pain it is, though we may wonder who is in pain if it's not us. So it's not like we can go, hey, there's a pain here. Is this yours? Or is it mine? Did somebody leave this?
Yeah.
The person who's in pain knows immediately that the pain belongs to him or her. This one who knows is a self. Therefore, there is a self. So again, the idea is it's not as if there are just anonymous pains out there waiting for somebody to claim them. If you're in pain, you know you are. If you're having an experience, you know it's yours. You don't have to figure that out by inference, or there can't be an argument about it. Ownership is sort of built into the immediate experience. Individuation. And knowing that one is oneself, as we all know we are ourselves, one knows directly of the existence of a distinct individual. Moreover, one presumably knows that this distinct individual is not tied to any particular set of properties other than being self-identical. You want to think of that as a property. So you think sometimes, we all go through these sorts of thought experiments at one time or another. Oh, I could have been embodied or disembodied. If you've read Descartes' Meditations, you've thought about that. Could have been rich or poor, healthy or unhealthy, born in the 20th century or in the 13th, have been male or female, European or Asian, an alien or an earthling, a cop or a criminal, and so on. All those variations. And yet, we think, would it remain fundamentally this particular individual that knows itself? So when you see movies, for example, that involve people trading bodies and so on, this is the kind of thing they're trading on, this idea that there is this distinct individual that is you, that would remain you no matter what body it was stuck in, no matter what any of these accidental properties or roles it happens to have, happens to fill. Still be used. The idea is that that's just a way to try to isolate this individuating factor that doesn't depend on any description that happens to be true about you, to be true of you. So this individuating factor, the argument goes, is the self. So there's a self. This thing that does the individuating separates you from all the other selves. The phenomenological argument. So this is, based on an appeal to a very salient fact about conscious experience. We're always aware of things from a certain point of view. Objects always appear to you, to me. In other words, the world is present to you. The very structure of experience involves the presence of something to someone. Accordingly, the idea of appearances that just appear, but appear to no one, like our anonymous pains that belong to no one, the idea is that's absurd. If there's any experience of anything at all, it's someone's experience, and it's an experience to someone, to a subject. That to which the world appears, or anything appears, is a self. So, there's a self. Alright. So we had the individuation argument, the phenomenological argument, the ownership argument, and the unity argument. Arguments against the self. We're going to find a phenomenological counter-argument. It's also an appeal to experience. It's a counter-argument. An argument that the self is not really needed to account for the unity of experience. And what I'm going to call the argument for neuroscience. But I say that broadly, so I'm including neurology, psychiatry, psychology, and some pretty garden variety facts about our own development. So here's a phenomenological counter-argument. We'll look at a famous passage from David Hume's Treatise of Human Nature. For my part, Hume said, when I enter most intimately into what I call myself, I always stumble on some particular perception or other of heat or cold, light or shade, love or hatred, pain or pleasure. I never can catch myself at any time without a perception. I never can observe anything but the perception. If anyone, upon serious and unprejudiced reflection, thinks he has a different notion of himself, I must confess I can reason no longer with him. All I can allow him is that he may be in the right as well as I, and that we are essentially different in this particular. He may perhaps perceive something simple and continued, which he calls himself. Though I am certain there's no such principle in me. Now, sometimes this passage is kind of misread, and people jokingly say, ah, you know, Hume says that he just can't find himself at all. That he has no self. Well, right, but understood in a particular way. Understood as self out here, understood as a kind of simple and continued thing that is distinguishable from any particular experience. Something that can be separated out from experience. The way I can separate this piece of technology and this inferior one and say this one is next to this one. So Hume's looking for this kind of unifying, individuating, simple thing that simple and continued, maintains its identity over time, that he can just pull out and separate from other objects of experience and set right next to it. So there are a couple of conflicting intuitions here. So in the one phenomenological argument, the phenomenological argument for self, it says, look, experience has this to me, or for me. Did everyone hear that?
Only our own experience.
GPS experience. As I was saying, the first phenomenological argument basically says, look, experience is always to me, so there must be something to whom it is, to whom things appear. Well, then Hume says that, but when we try to find this thing, we can't. It's a kind of phenomenological counter-argument. Look into your experience, see if you can find this thing to whom experience is. And you won't find it. You'll just find more experiences. So we can agree that conscious experience seems relational. It does seem to involve the presence of the world to someone, or to have a subject-object structure. However, as Hume suggests, when we go looking explicitly for the subject relatum, we do not find it. We do not find an entity that's separable from all the other objects of experience. In fact, we find that there's always the experience of something going on. It begins to look rather like the self, if there is such a thing, is either symmetrically dependent upon its objects, as if it's got to be the objects and the self in some kind of relation at the time. Could be a symmetrical dependence, as an idealist might think, or asymmetrically dependent upon them, like a parasite, to use one of Sartre's metaphors, like a worm. In other words, that the objects sort of support consciousness. So they have to be there. Some object or other has to be there to support this thing. So how do we square the relational character of conscious experience with the apparent absence of a self relatum? How do we make sense of these two conflicting intuitions? That there's something to whom everything appears, and the fact that we just can't find what this thing is. We can't sort of isolate it as a thing in experience. I'll make a suggestion about how to resolve this problem in a moment, in the sequel. First, let me look at a couple of other counter-arguments. Sort of to finish the phenomenological counter-argument, we now need to talk about these other arguments, because it makes kind of a whole. Alright, so I think we can agree that conscious experience is both synchronically and diachronically unified. So at a time. I'm aware of many things going on at once. And over time, there's a connection. Connection, even in the midst of, say, speaking, uttering a sentence. The words have to come out serially, and I have to wait, and you have to wait till I get to the end of the sentence to know what the sentence means. So you have to drag all that stuff with you over time till you got to the end. You go, yeah, got it. So that's a very short-term diachronic unification. But then if you just keep building up these, you get longer-term streams of experience. And then you go to sleep, and the whole thing gets wiped out, and then a new one starts. Start climbing the hill again. So the question is, does this kind of unity that we all know and love, does it require a self for its explanation? Some kind of enduring entity that somehow effects this, either by being a kind of thing that, you know, as if it has arms grabbing these different experiences, or it's like a property that gets reinstantiated, special property that gets reinstantiated, say, by all the experiences, like, you know, Ken Williford Hood, you know. Which ones are yours? Which experiences are yours? The ones that have Ken Wilbur. Which ones are, you know, yours? Which ones are this Ken's? Ones that have Ken Sauter height? Ken Sauter hood. Sure. We can make it abstract. I don't know. So the question is, do we need something like that? One of those two models of a self-unifying experience? Or can we make sense of the unity without any such entity or property? Can it be accounted for with less ontological cost by the fact that episodes in a stream of consciousness are multiply causally connected, and that the brain and bodily dispositions that ground memory, intelligence, conceptual capacity, personality, and behavioral tendencies are relatively stable? So the question is, do we need this entity itself, or can we just make sense of this by the stability of brain processes and dispositions? That's the question. So on this alternative view, the notion of a self is really an abstraction from the unity of consciousness and the usual stability of these dispositions, not something that accounts for or explains that unity. This, by the way, is straight out of Jean-Paul Sartre's book, Transcendence of the Ego. It makes exactly the same argument, except it doesn't mention the brain. They didn't really know what to say. We can say, not excluded from talking about the brain, as he could sort of prohibited himself from that move. We could say, why isn't it that whatever accounts for the stability and the causal continuity of consciousness over time, whatever brain processes do this, why isn't that sufficient? Why do we need some other thing? And doesn't it make more sense, along Sartrean lines, to think that the notion of a self as this kind of entity is really an abstraction from a unity that we find? It's kind of an abstract object we cook up. That's the alternative account, which we'll come back to in a minute. So basically, the explanatory emptiness part here says that a self, either conceived of as a little homuncular entity that remains constant over time, or a property that gets reinstantiated all the time, these don't really explain anything. So do any explaining. They're just kind of reifications or abstractions that we then reify from a unity that can be explained in another way, and in a way that has less ontological cost. We don't have to imagine weird entities that somehow get stuck into our, you know, come to inhabit meat puppets like us. know that these usually stable brain and bodily dispositions can be degraded or undermined in a great variety of ways. I probably should have called this the argument from neuropathology. Put it this way. You can lose your memories, or you can, your old ones, or you can lose your ability to form new ones. And that does, both of these, do very odd things to your conception of yourself. There's a movie, actually, it's called Unknown White Male. Has anybody seen this thing? I'd really be interested to know if it's not a hoax. Because the guy, like, you know, wakes up one day with severe anterograde amnesia. Doesn't remember anything about himself, what he was doing or anything. And he has a totally different personality. I'm not saying that kind of thing doesn't happen. It's just that in that particular case, I started saying, something kind of hoaxish about this movie. But apparently, nobody's been able to show that it's a hoax. But it's a nice movie, even if it were a hoax. It's a nice kind of thought experiment about what happens to your sense of personal identity, your sense of an autobiographical selfhood, when you suddenly have no memories at all about your past. We can, as we all know, gain new abilities, lose old ones, kind of ingrain certain new dispositions, and lose ones that we once had. Your personality, one's personality can undergo radical changes. Sometimes they're temporary, sometimes they're permanent, due to all kinds of things. Drug use, trauma, strokes, religious conversions, falling in love. That's a big personality. It does all kinds of weird things with people's personality. And changing their life. Furthermore, the brain, like all organs, is in constant flux. Its ability to maintain its overall form throughout the change of its matter is robust, but ultimately limited. We find no single constant, literally identical individual entity in it. Kind of like we can find the self spot, the thing that is the self. We find only similarity of processes, patterns, and form over time. So, you know, all the matter in your body, in your brain, is being replaced all the time. What gets maintained are structures, forms, not particular matter, not particular entities. If the self were the seat of essential personality features, the ultimate ground of agency, the unique individuator that remains constant through all contingent change, shouldn't we expect to be impervious to these brain changes? Are we to imagine that a human being undergoing the later stages of Alzheimer's disease really contains essentially the same self that was 20 years old and thriving 60 years earlier? Are we to imagine that a human tripping, it's really not the right word for this particular type of drug, but tripping for 72 hours on dissociative tropane alkaloids, these are contained in Jimson weed, you heard of Jimson weed, Datura. This is totally legal, by the way. It's because it has such low abuse potential. Nobody wants to be doing that. It's like 72 hours can possibly cause pretty serious, it's very neurotoxic, can be neurotoxic, very neurotoxic. 72 hours on dissociative tropane alkaloids. Usually people they don't remember what happened. They did all kinds of crazy things, don't remember much of what they were doing. We can imagine that a person undergoing that during the trip, say, is the same self, really, only hindered from expressing itself because the drugs have interfered with its control of the brain. As if there's like this little self and they're going, try to restore it. If we say yes, we're driven to postulate, we start getting pushed in the direction, you know, of postulating an essentially immaterial entity, or if it's material, then it's, say, otherwise undetectable, something mysterious so far, that nonetheless has causal powers and connects to individual meat puppets in some mysterious way. We being the puppet, our bodies being the puppet, right? And it being the captain connecting to the brain trying to control all this. Just saying, to think about, you know, the implications of holding on to the notion of some kind of essential self that's distinct from the brain processes. So is this really an alternative to that, the idea that there is such a self? So it's hard to understand how consciousness could be a brain process. That's certainly true. Kind of hard to sit there and go, well, this experience right now is really just a process going on in my brain. Somehow it connects me with the external world. And granted, hard. But it's, of course, no harder than, I should say, understanding how it could be anything else. Or how it could be a fundamental feature of reality. An irreducible fundamental feature, like David Chalmers thinks. So granted that that's hard, given the evidence we have about it, doesn't it make more sense and come with less ontological cost to hold that it is, nonetheless, such a process? Fine, you might say. But what about the important phenomenology of unity, subjectivity, presence to, individuality, and ownership? All these things that drove the arguments for the self in the first place. Can we faithfully describe that, those features, without recourse to a self? Yes. All right, here we go. This is a professor of mine once said, if you can draw your view of the mind on a napkin, it must be a false view. So I've tried to draw my view of the mind on a sheet of paper instead of a napkin. In any case, this is a... Don't worry about the details. The idea here... all these details here. Look right here. Think of this as the flow of consciousness. There's time down here. If you think about the way your experience goes, remember how this example about dragging the sentence, the words that I just, you know, that were uttered in the past into the present, for kind of anticipating an end, and then when you finally get to the end of the sentence, you've understood a complete thought, right? We just dragged all this stuff up. So a couple of things go on in there. You reach what the phenomenologist Husserl called retending the past and protending the future. And we do this all the time. So these little lines here mean retention. These are, say, the things you're aware of, the various dimensions of your experience, seeing things, smelling things, hearing things, and so on, at any given time. These are kind of artificially, I've broken these into different episodes. It's very hard to know exactly how to individuate an episode of consciousness. But, nonetheless, somehow they are individuated over time. What's going on now is not what was going on 15 minutes ago. So the idea here is, these arrows pointing forward are protensions. These pointing backwards are retentions. And these little loops, this is your immediate reflexive awareness. The awareness that a conscious episode has, not of the self, but of itself at any moment. Let me reduce it a little bit. So temporality gets sort of thought of this way. Here's an episode. It's protending the future. Like if I flipped a coin, everybody would expect it to come down. just sort of implicit in the experience that the thing is going to come down. You're not predicting that it's going to come down. It's not like you said, hey, I've got a prediction. That coin will come down. You kind of predict it. You just expect it to come down. Pretending the immediate future and retending the past. So think again of sentences or of understanding a, or hearing a musical phrase. Dun, 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 dun. You had to get all that. Dun, dun, so that makes, dun, is heard a certain way. And then you pretend, of course, the rest of the phrase. Dun, 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 dun. And if it doesn't turn out the way you expected, you go, oh, surprise. The Russians are coming. It's Red Dawn. Just kidding. Anyway. So then think of this as sort of your outer directed awareness of your surroundings. And this, again, this is this sense of this here now. This that's going on right here now. This episode of experience going on right here now. Reflexive awareness is the very ground of subjectivity on this sort of view. Intentionality here, synchronic unity, the sense that many things happen. It's just the phenomenological model. Again, how it all happened, how it all works actually is something that philosophy can't tell us or phenomenology can't tell us. Only neuroscience can tell us this. If anything. So, unity, etc. Subjectivity and so on, with no self. So the relational structure of experience, the to-me aspect, is taken care of on this model just by reflexive awareness plus intentionality. So there's presence to, yes. And what is this thing to which it's present? That you can isolate. The relatum is the very experience itself. It's not a thing separable from the experience, but the experience is present to itself, so it's the subject relatum. Synchronic unity is a function of large-scale information integration, perhaps, according to Giulio Tononi, a neuroscientist who's developed a theory of consciousness that in some ways is rather bizarre, but at least for that feature, I think we might be able to agree. Diachronic unity, and by extension memory, the function of multiple, mostly subpersonal causal connections, plus similarity over time. So the way your sort of experience seems to you now is quite similar to the one that happened just a few seconds ago, and so on back. So it gives a kind of a sense of stability. Something that remains the same in many dimensions over time, remains similar, without any kind of entity that's literally identical. The immediate sense of self, me here now, this here now, is a function of reflexive awareness. The sense that it was I who experienced X, when you remember something, it's a function of the fact that reflexive awareness is always implicitly remembered whenever any experience is remembered. In other words, there is always this subject. Any experience you can remember had a subject, and you identify it implicitly with the current subject. That's the very same structure. So you're just remembering a repeated structure, not a special entity. And reflexive awareness is always anticipated. And so long as an experience occurs, that anticipation is never disappointed. So, for example, you think, oh, yeah, tomorrow we'll go and do that. And tomorrow comes and you go and do that, whatever it was. Here I am doing that, just like I thought. So you project into the future the occurrence of exactly this same kind of structure that you have right now and that you always had in the past. This kind of reflexive awareness. And then, if you remember that, the way I told you we'd be doing this today, yesterday, I told you we'd be doing this today, you're remembering the fulfillment of that prediction, of that anticipation. you're remembering that you predicted it, that it's fulfilled. It gives you this kind of sense of a thing that endures over time. Let's skip that. Not worry about that. Reflexive awareness is rather puzzling, that's true, but it's not a self-entity or a homunculus. It's just a repeated structure of consciousness. In one sense, it, along with other essential structures of consciousness, is the kernel of identity over time, but it's not an entity. It's a set of structures, and the set is generically the same in all conscious beings. Individuality and hence ownership are a function of whatever it is that ultimately individuates physical objects, and we need not have access to what individuates to know that we are individuals. So you don't have to say, I can find a special individual thing that makes me me just by introspecting. That you are individuated, you know, but what individuates you, that's whatever individuates physical objects. Last slide. No, wait. For this joke. So, what about the concept of the self? Like, why do we sort of imagine this thing and reify it and tell stories about it and make plans, get insurance policies for it and everything else we do? Well, I think one function, this again is something you can find in Sartre and many other people, it's the idea that you need some notion of a, we like some notion of a self, an ideal self, this thing that we think we really are, that we really ought to be. Often people just identify their current, you know, self with this thing that they think they ought to be. It's a source of endless trouble to do this. But at the same time, it provides a kind of mechanism for guiding your behavior. Am I the kind of person that does that? No. I'm not. I won't do that. I don't want to be that kind of person. I'm not that kind of person. Or you kind of slide between, this is what I ought to be and this is what I am. It's also a very convenient fiction for social and political purposes. Especially if you like to punish things. That's, you know, our society does. It loves punishment. Retributive punishment in particular. That's probably the most, the more pernicious aspect of it, though, is this idea of retributive punishment. If there really is no self, in the sense I'm suggesting, retributive punishment is actually impossible. You can never punish the thing that committed the crime, because it's long gone in the past. Nonetheless, there's a flip side, which is it's very convenient to like say, oh yeah, I'm the same guy who was born in Fort Worth. It has this social security number and so on. Alright. And it does provide a certain kind of psychological stability. Well, look, the next whole part is about the self and ethics, because you might ask yourself, what does this do about the notion of moral responsibility? Where does the buck stop? It doesn't stop. And you might ask, does this make ethical egoism especially irrational? I think it does, actually. We don't have time to go into that, so maybe the question answer period. Thank you for your attention.
We're going to entertain some questions for Dr. Williford, and I'm going to take advantage here as the moderator to ask the first question. Can we co-equate or say that it's identical with, self is identical with consciousness or self-consciousness, because after all, you know, without the brain being conscious, we're not aware of self. Animals aren't aware, they're not self-conscious, so they don't have a self. And that consciousness can be distorted and changed, so that part of the self is changed. So tell me, what's the difference, or is it the same thing as consciousness?
So I think that, so here's my view about this. I think the self, thought of as an entity or a center of narrative gravity, a kind of autobiographical self, is just a convenient fiction. So in that sense, it shouldn't be identified with consciousness or anything else. However, the common sense notion of the self, that we all sort of, you know, grow up on, and that is partially enshrined into our legal system, our political systems, and so on, our institutions. Some of that notion stems from conscious experience. And as I was saying at one point, it's a kind of abstraction from the unity of conscious experience. And our experience of issuing decisions, and so on, our inability to trace where decisions come from, the kind of take absence of, like Spinoza said, we imagine ourselves to be free because we are ignorant of the causes of our behavior. Right? Something along those lines. So I wouldn't equate them, but there is an important relationship.
Yeah, you mentioned that other country's national anthem, and
well, it was interesting that even in a country where they didn't believe in the soul at all, because they were atheists, they did believe and had to act as if there was a self. And in the area of retributive justice, definitely had many laws concerning that. And they had different rhetoric in terms of the ethics than we would, instead of, you stole my property, or you killed my son. They would, you know, say, you are a wrecker of public property. But they definitely had retributive justice. And it seems to me, not just in terms of utility, that we sort of need a sense of self in order to have a society that works for anyone, but even in terms of just identifying these clumps of brains that come up with the same kinds of decisions over and over again after a certain time period, if they haven't had alcohol and they're the mayor of Toronto or something like that. But if they're children instead of senile adults, that sort of thing. In fact, the reason we exclude sometimes, the reason we have elder care law, or the reason we have law concerning juveniles as opposed to adults, is we say, well, your brain isn't formed yet. Your pattern of behavior as a response to your genetics and environment isn't formed yet and stable, so we don't hold you responsible. But after a certain age, you're the software, you're the self. It seems to me that we can identify that as a self, even if we don't believe in a soul.
Yeah, so I guess the notion of self that I'm attacking, or I'm skeptical of, you know, it's pretty close to the notion of a soul. So if all we mean by self is some kind of seat, relatively stable seat of dispositions that is usually conscious, well, usually, how much do we sleep? Without dreaming, whatever the exact breakdown is, it's usually conscious. It can usually make, reasonably accurate predictions about the likely consequences of its decision, of its actions, and so on. If that's all we mean by self, then I'm fine with that. So if we want to think of it as just a, from the phenomenological point of view, just this connected stream of experiences that is individuated and is embodied in a body that has certain dispositions, tendencies, capacities, then that's fine with me to call it itself. That's sort of all we need to ground to sort of fulfill most of the social and political functions and, you know, scorekeeping functions and so on that it has up to now. What I don't like, let me add to that. What I do think is that the notion of retribution depends on a more robust kind. Depends on a concept like this thing that committed that crime a few years ago is the thing I'm punishing now, and that's more like a concept of the soul. Doesn't mean I think there shouldn't be punishment, but just that the function of punishment should be deterrence and preventing harm. Because if something has a set of dispositions that they exercise by, you know, committing a murder or something, it seems, you know, it's likely that they still maintain that set of dispositions over time, even though it's not the identical soul or person.
No, there's like,
so there's a
continuity. Deterrence as opposed to getting even.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, deterrence or preventing harm versus getting even. Okay.
Go ahead.
My only question is that, or my point is that your attack on whether or not there is a self reminds me of the attacks on whether or not there is a mind,
oh.
Because because philosophers sometimes assume that if you can't find a thing that has a mind or a thing that has a self, that it doesn't exist just because it's part of the brain. I would argue with defining a self or a mind as a thing and argue that it is a process in the brain. And just because it's part of the brain doesn't negate that it exists.
Okay. So, again, I think depending on what we mean, we might be able to agree. So, I think consciousness, so I would never say that there's no mind or no consciousness. And there are people that have defended that view. I mean, say, did they do it unconsciously? I guess they did, if they're right.
So that's a very difficult
thesis to, I to this day I can't wrap my head around how somebody can take it seriously, right? That there's no consciousness. I think consciousness is a brain process. If we want to say that a self is really a process, and it's related to consciousness, but it also includes certain sets of dispositions that are relatively stable over time. If we want to say that's what I mean by self, then again, I'm totally fine with that. I don't reject the existence of that. I just reject the existence of some kind of entity or soul or thing that maintains its identity over time, throughout all these changes and experience and so on. Because I think that creates this kind of, we can account for all the phenomena without that.
I very much liked your talk, and you started out with the concept of a...
Did you want this? It was next.
You started out with the concept of a unified mind theory, divided mind theory. You slightly spoke around those terms. And as we all know, throughout life, we can disagree with ourselves. We can say, do I want this interpretation, my self-interpretation of this event, this way or that way? Sometimes it takes a while to decide those things. But then you brought in the concept of a punishment in a conditional area. So if someone does something, are they liable for it? Well, at the same time, you might ask that society, should the punishment go to the caregivers of a person who is given a psychotropic drug and then given therapy that releases their mind along a certain train of thought?
Are you have a question there?
Are they responsible? Yeah. Are the caregivers then responsible for that person's behavior, getting a drug and then releasing your mind along by experience along certain areas?
Okay. So
so not only the individual being responsible, are other members of society responsible as a caregiver?
I don't understand moral responsibility in quite the way that it's commonsensically understood. It seems to me that the way it's commonsensically understood, you need some notion of libertarian free will to make this way commonsensically understood. As if decisions, you know, the buck stops with somebody who issued a decision, and they did it freely, did it out of their own nature, or however it goes.
If you're not aware of a drug that might be used at the same time,
We're going to have to let other people ask questions, okay? Just keep the comments short. Sorry, did you ask a question?
Well, the short answer is yes, of course, caregivers are responsible.
Thank you.
But
In order to, for everybody to have a chance to ask questions, please kind of keep your comments short and form it in the form of a question for our speaker, please.
Well, my question is, I don't usually hear this kind of argument. It's the body argument, which is my body, you're a unique, standalone, no one ever confuses where it ends and someone else begins. All the things in it are also unique, my heart, my nose, and so on, and my brain. And so feelings, memories, sense of self, my belief that I have myself, all of that is the contents of the goings-on of that brain, then they also have to be a unique standalone collection of things. And that uniqueness is, I would say, the self. The people never talk about the whole body, they stop with the brain or something. Have you heard of, what do you, have you heard about using the whole body instead of just the brain?
Yeah, I guess so. I guess I think it doesn't make that much difference. I mean, since the brain is, you know, integrated with the rest of your body, it's just that there's pretty good evidence that consciousness narrowly supervenes on brain processes. We can lose all kinds of parts of our body and so on, and still have consciousness, but if we lose our brain, we can't. Right? So that's I think why philosophers who, like me, tend to just talk about the brain. But nobody can deny that without your functioning body, you know, your brain's not going to live very long. But that may just be a technological limitation that we hopefully one that will remain. Which of brains advance around the place, but the other question seemed to be about individuation, and since your body is uniquely individuated. So that goes right along with what I'm saying. Whatever it is that individuates your body and your brain is sufficient to individuate consciousness. It's not as if there is some other special individuator that you have some kind of access to, like, you know, Ken Williford Ness or something like that. It's not like a special essence that belongs to each person, or a special little entity, a little homunculus kind of thing.
Yeah, I guess you're really arguing against duality and saying that that the self is something that is a function of the physical brain, and I guess because the brain is connected to the senses, and that's the way we interact with the environment, that fact that everybody has an individual brain defines that individual self. I guess my question is, though, why are you saying that the self is a fiction? I mean, you might as well say the body is a fiction. It's a bundle of properties that it's very hard to find a single simple description for, and some of them may be present, some of them may be absent. You could lose your eyes, or you could lose your ability to see or to hear, but you'd still be the self. But you wouldn't be a complete self, I think. So why do you say it's a fiction?
Well, I say it's a... Okay, so basically once I've convinced myself, so to speak, if to translate, once these episodes of consciousness have done some reasoning and come to the conclusion that I can't, like as Hume says, can't find any kind of entity that remains this seat of identity over time, it's changeless kind of thing.
Well, the functioning of the brain is an entity.
Right. I agree. But look, we can't find this thing either phenomenologically, or let's say we don't need it to make sense of the phenomenology.
Right.
And we don't find it in the brain when we look at the brain.
It's in the brain, but it's what the brain does.
If you put it that way, then it's more along the lines of what she was saying.
Right.
Then I don't really disagree.
Okay.
That there's this kind of more or less stable, but it changes. And that there are structures that are re-instantiated all the time.
Right.
In particular, this sense of me here, this here now,
right.
when you're conscious. And then you have these basic bodily dispositions that are relatively stable. Usually they change slowly unless there's some kind of trauma or break or something.
But I wouldn't like to think that I was the person I was when I was 5 years old or 2 years old, for instance.
Yeah,
I mean, that would be very uncomfortable. I mean, I am changing.
Yeah, we could be regressed for that. Psychologically, you could be regressed.
But
I couldn't reintroduce to that,
So I basically agree. Mm. It's just that sometimes people think that we need this more robust notion, something like a soul that doesn't change.
Right.
So when we say, I am in that picture, we literally mean this same identical thing. Entity.
We can still hold that entity responsible. Because it has to learn, and it has to be an example for the rest of society to learn to change their selves in accordance with the needs of the moral needs or the ethical needs of the society.
I suppose, like, as long as we don't think that there's some changeless entity that is the soul itself.
I'm losing control.
Sorry.
When we're through with the questions and answers, I'm sure the speaker will stay for a while for informal discussion with him, you know, on a one-to-one if you want to. Okay, good. But let's try to keep the questions as short and just, you know, once you've said your thing, we'll leave it go and let the next person go.
Okay.
I feel terrible pressure here. So I feel we've been lured into a false dichotomy of does it exist or not? Does the self exist or not? And I think it's which aspect of ourselves we're thinking of. And in some cases, the problem is better approached by thinking of ourselves as having a self. I'm a retired physician. I can guarantee that 100% of the people that came in to see me did so because they presumed they had a self that they were very concerned about, and they, for example, had an immune system that would attack invading organisms that they identified as non-self. So my question would be, could it be that this is all sort of a wordplay and that we are what we are, and that certain aspects, certain problems are better approached by thinking of ourselves as being individual and certain aspects as not? I didn't know which answer. It was I quick enough?
That's a short answer to maybe. But I think that... I was going after a sort of very specific notion of a self that has a kind of robust metaphysics that goes along with it. That you find in Descartes, you find if you think that there is a changeless soul that comes to inhabit meat puppets and leaves after death and so on. So I think we can say everything we want to say without any such notion of it. We can say everything we want to say, recognizing that we have connected streams of consciousness, we have bodily dispositions that arise and develop and then decline, decay, everything is in process, and so on. All we need are sort of stable dispositions and stable recurrent patterns of brain processing and so on. Nothing, no bigger metaphysics than that. So, does that answer your question?
I used my idea that it can be viewed either way, logically. I don't feel that you repeated my...
But when you say it can be viewed, do you mean that you can view it in terms of a enduring entity that stays the same throughout the whole development of the body and brain and maybe endures after?
I'm saying 100% of your... presumably, every infection you've had has been resolved by your body identifying it as not you and making an immune response to it.
I, yeah,
completely accept that. But that, I don't need this any kind of notion of an immortal soul or to make sense of that.
Right.
Yeah, if I need to send that more to less.
Right. Send me a tweet.
Great speech, excellent speech, and I really agree with your depiction of the self. So my question is, does the self as you depict it have free will? Is the self, is it promoted by deterministic elements, environment, genetics? And if it is, if you do believe in a deterministic element of the self, do you believe it is like soft determinism or hard determinism?
You know, I was afraid that actually, I'll tell you what I don't believe.
See, it's harder for me to say what I do think about this because I haven't quite met my mind. I'll tell you, I think the notion of libertarian free will is incoherent. And the notion of agent causation is incoherent. And that these are illusions that we suffer from. Just like Spinoza said, simply because we're ignorant, we don't have access to the ultimate causes of our behavior. So I don't think there's any kind of little decider that magically issues decisions out of its essence, you know, it's like Nietzschean individual essence, or what, out of no essence at all and for no particular reason at all. Which is what sort of what it would take to really show that you've got this thing. This is why Dostoevsky thought that really to prove free will, you need to, like the underground man, do things that are absolutely contrary to your own interests, and to know that you're doing that. You're kind of thumbing your nose at the laws of nature, showing that I can act against self-interest, watch me, and then go do something horrible. As most Dostoevsky characters in the film.
So I'm interested in why you have this hang up on.
That's a good question. I mean, so this is kind of like
this non-changing thing. And I think, I know at least a few people in this room who are non-theists or otherwise that became aware of themselves as a self or as a individual or whatever you want to call it when they were about 3 or 4 years old. But I don't think any of those people think that that's the same person that exists today when they have white hair. And they quite easily, most of them, are able to deal with change and the ambiguity that goes along with life.
So, okay. So the question is, why am I hunting down this particular will-o'-the-wisp?
That's a really good question. I hadn't asked myself before too deeply. Really, are you asking about my own motivations?
Well, I mean, you seem like you think that it would not be good for people to have this concept of some solid, non-changeable thing called a self or a soul or whatever.
Right.
And it seems like that's something that you are fixated with.
Are you just a pagan missionary?
I
just let you know there are a few people out there that don't have that hang up.
I agree with you that there are some people out there, but
I don't know there are.
I don't know. But there are people who have plenty of hang-ups that go in the other direction.
Yes.
So, and I think that one way to kind of get at your own, everybody's own tendency toward egoism, which we all have, a way to kind of moderate that innate tendency we have is to reflect on this fact more so than we do. And our common way of speaking and our institutionalization of certain practices like retributive punishment all tend to reinforce the idea that there is this kind of stable thing that can, you know, reap the reward of its efforts and so on. So I kind of think that produces a, you know,
it's one of the foundations of the kind of egoism that's fairly fairly common in the thinking of a lot of people in our culture. So I'm glad to hear that you don't have a problem.
Well, Rolf stole my question, so I'm going to ask a slightly different one. In neuroscience, of course, we're always saying that neurons that fire together wire together, yeah. And we come up with these 40 hertz oscillations in the brain. And could you comment on if you think that's what originates consciousness or something very similar to that?
I got kind of disappointed with neuroscientific theories of consciousness because, for the most part, I felt like they were either philosophical theories of consciousness in disguise, like Damasio's theory, basically a higher order or maybe a same order representationalist theory in disguise, or they just weren't, they just didn't have enough conceptual innards to really make you feel like you've made a real connection to phenomenology. So like the 40 hertz that Francis Crick and astonishing hypothesis is what they call it. It seemed to me to be just, okay, yeah, maybe it's getting on to binding. That's kind of what initiated the thought. Binding of what they call bind, integration, kind of creating what I call synchronic unity. That could be a factor in it. I'm not up on the how the literature played out on that particular hypothesis, but it alone is not sort of doesn't give enough theoretical guts, conceptual guts to go, oh yeah, I see how that connects to lived experience in a way. Now, Damasio tried to do this by focusing on the subjectivity side, the self, the proto-self, but it was a kind of representationalist theory. You represent yourself, basically, and this is what generates consciousness. Tononi, and now Christoph Koch, who used to collaborate with Francis Crick before he died, Tononi kind of converted Christoph Koch to this information integration theory, which basically says consciousness is just information integration. And to the extent that things are informationally integrated, they're conscious. It has the bizarre consequence that, given the way they define information integration in terms of mutual information, it just means causal connectivity, basically. And all kinds of things turn out to be conscious that you wouldn't think would be, like your phone. I've always thought it might be. I find that kind of a bit too crazy.
It's almost 8:30, so we have time for one short question and answer. Very short.
Okay. Recently, it's been determined that 90% of the cells you carry around are not human. They are various bacteria that live within you and parasites.
Yeah, yeah.
And more recently, they found that these parasites and bacteria change human behavior and change human consciousness. Think of toxoplasmosis, and of course, even lately, even gut bacteria have found to change human consciousness. So it's increasingly evident, I feel, that all of self is symbiotic. That there is not one entity, but it's this group of entities that inhabit your body that tell you who you are and what you do.
Okay.
So in that respect, I mean, rather than being trying to punish someone for something, perhaps
just punish all of them.
A good course of antibiotics might get the job done.
A bunch of little cells get together with a big cell, right?
Why not?
As if. I mean, it's kind of like the standard problem of panpsychism. It's the view that, like, everything's conscious, so it's no wonder that you are. But some are all your parts, And then somehow they all get together and make like this sense of me, this, you know, the principal monad, is what Leibniz called it.
Like toxoplasmosis is the principal reason why residents blow themselves up in cat-like size.
Okay.
So, yeah, and that happens in rats, too.
Well, I guess what I guess I should make them not influencing your behavior, but somehow constituting the influence.
Majorly. Yeah.
But influencing.
That's why his love bangs dogs and favors cats.
Any other questions? I guess this has been such an interesting talk, and we could go on all night. I know everybody wants a big comment. Would you turn off the podcast? As a token of our appreciation, here's a little certificate
and
an honorary degree.
An honorary degree. Yeah, you can add about here. And then here's a little
awesome. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And feel free to come up and ask him questions.